It is 9:30 on Thursday, June 27th, 2024. We're at the California Natural Resources Building at 715 P Street in Sacramento, California. My name is Julie Lee, and I am the chair of the Delta Stewardship Council. And I'm going to turn it over to Emma now to explain how the public can participate in this meeting.
Any member of the public is interested in providing public comment on any agenda item during today's meeting, please send an email blue card to engage@deltacouncil.ca.gov as seen on the screen. Be sure to note your name and the agenda item you wish to speak on. When called, the clerk will unmute you.
Thanks, Emma. Can you lead us in the roll call, please?
Councilmember Burgess.
Here.
Councilmember Damrell.
Here.
Councilmember Hueso.
Here.
Councilmember Zingali.
Here.
Chair Lee.
Here. Thank you. This item is for the public to comment on any topic not on the council's agenda. Any comments on items on the agenda will be taken during that item. Emma, do we have any public comments for items not on today's agenda?
Yes, we do. May you please say a name before you begin your comments?
Thank you. Good morning, council members. My name is Kelly Tabor. I'm an attorney with Somac, Simmons & Dunn. We represent the County of Sacramento and the City of Stockton, the Sacramento Area Sewer District, and other parties who are currently opposing the Delta Conveyance Project and litigation in the Sacramento County Superior Court, is also at the State Water Resources Control Board. As the council, it should be aware, the Sacramento County Superior Court issued a preliminary injunction last month, finding that the Department of Water Resources was in violation of the Delta Reform Act in attempting to implement the Delta Conveyance Project in advance of bringing a certification of consistency to this council. Last night, with very little notice, the department served on all of the parties who had filed the motion for preliminary injunction a procedurally improper ex parte motion to modify the injunction based on no new evidence, but based in part on a declaration submitted by the Delta Stewardship Council staff in support of that motion. And to be clear, this motion seeks to have Judge Acristo in the Sacramento County Superior Court make a determination about the consistency of the Delta Conveyance Project with the Delta Plan, the same issue that will be coming before this council at whatever time the department chooses to file its certification. It is outrageous to the people and governments of the Delta that the Delta Stewardship Council staff would put their thumb on the scale by filing a declaration. Second declaration, I will note, because they also filed a declaration in support of DWR's opposition to the preliminary injunction, the second declaration in as many months, again, arguing in favor of the Department of Water Resources. The people of the Delta, this creates a perception, at the minimum, a perception of bias, and it's improper. And the people of the Delta deserve an explanation of how this is happening. And I'll just note that although she couldn't be here this morning because she is working on opposing this ex parte application, another attorney for the Delta public agency spoke with your counsel, your lawyer, last week on this very issue, objecting to the Stewardship Council's putting its thumb on the scale in support of the Department of Water Resources on an issue that's going to come before this council, and was assured that the council was trying to maintain a position of neutrality while submitting a declaration in support of an attempt to make an end run around this council's decision-making authority, the public's right to appeal any consistency determination is not neutral. And the public deserves an explanation of how this is and why this is happening. Thank you.
I can respond to that really quickly. The declaration that was
submitted. Your microphone's not on.
Is it on?
Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay, so the declaration was prepared or signed by Jeff Henderson and our staff, and all it did was give a neutral authentication of documents. no more nor less. It's not in a position to present arguments. That's just not true. It is simply authenticating documents that are publicly accessible, no more nor less. It authenticated two things. It authenticated a publicly available staff-created table that shows the Delta Plan policies, and it authenticated another document that's part of the that's a publicly available document that's part of the council's records. It doesn't express an opinion one way or another. A declaration in support is just a terminology in the court. It just means it's part of the evidence submitted by one side. It doesn't mean that the council's taking a position one side or the other supporting the thing.
Thanks for clarifying that. I appreciate it. Emma, are there any other public comments for items not on today's agenda?
No, Madam Chair, there are not.
Okay, thank you. We have one item on the consent calendar. It's the adoption of the June 27th, 2024 meeting summary. Members?
Adoption.
Okay. Any second?
A second.
Thank you. Before we vote, are there any public comments on the items on the consent calendar?
No, Madam Chair, there are not.
Okay, thank you. Emma, will you take a roll call vote?
Absolutely. Councilmember Burgess.
Aye.
Councilmember Demrell.
Yes.
Councilmember Weso.
Aye.
Councilmember Zingali.
Aye.
Chair Lee.
Aye. All right, the motion passes. Thank you. Next on our agenda is the chair's report. We've been doing a series of meet and greets with the help of our ledge deputy Brandon and Jessica Pearson. I've met with the Solano County supervisors Mitch Mashburn and John Vasquez. Those meetings have gone extremely well. Met with Yolo County supervisor Oscar Villegas, who is a former council member. So that was a great conversation to get his perspective kind of on the history of the council. Very helpful for me. We have a few upcoming meetings scheduled. Pat Hume with Sacramento County, and then we're still waiting for some dates for Steve Ding and Tom Patty. So we've got those on the agenda. In July, I also attended the Science for Communities workshop that we held. Was really well attended. There were 125 people there. The information was, I think, well received, and I think Jessica is going to talk more about that during her executive officer's reports. So that's kind of wraps it up for my month. Are there any public comments on this item, Emma?
No, Madam Chair, there are not.
And I'll turn it over to Jessica Pearson for the executive officer's report.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to start off with just touching upon the state budget situation, as that does have some impacts to our council. So in late June, Governor Newsom signed the state budget for fiscal year 2024-2025. Due to a significant projected $45 billion state budget shortfall, the budget includes a variety of deferrals and in some cases cuts to programs throughout state government. So the agreement requires that all state agencies, including the council, reduce operational spending by nearly 8% and eliminates funding for positions vacant as of July 1st. And this, as you may recall, comes on top of a 5% cut that we absorbed during the COVID pandemic. So given that we already have a fairly lean budget and even leaner program budget, this reduction is going to impact the council's work. And with that in mind, I plan to prioritize mission-related activities such as funding science and council-directed initiatives, and also exploring opportunities where we can defer work that is a non-priority and maintain a modest amount of budget flexibility throughout the year as unforeseen needs may evolve. So we're awaiting additional guidance from Department of Finance about the vacancy sweep and exactly how that is going to impact us, so I can keep you updated on that. I was pleased to also attend the Delta Supervisor meet and greets. It was great to meet with Solano County supervisors, who I had not previously spent a lot of time with, and to hear about their priorities. And particularly Supervisor Mitch Mashburn had a lot of interest in our Delta Science program and the work we do there with peer reviews, and also in the work of the Independent Science Board. So really good conversations there. And of course, always nice to spend time with Oscar Villegas as an alumni of the council. And as the chair mentioned, we did host our second Science for Communities workshop on July 12th at the San Joaquin Delta College in Stockton. These workshops are intended to match community-based organizations with agency and academic research scientists in order to partner and address important social environmental issues in the Delta. The event was a success. 125 people attended either online or in person, and issues of discussion and interest included harmful algal blooms, toxic fish consumption, emergency housing and floods in the Delta, and more. And this year, we also added a mentorship program during lunch, which everyone seemed to really appreciate. We have not had any covered actions filed in the last 30 days, so no new certifications. We did submit a comment letter on July 17th to the Brandon Andrus Levee Maintenance District regarding their Georgiana Slough Erosion Control and Habitat Enhancement Project. This is their environmental document notice of intent. The letter states that based on the location and scope, the project, it may meet the definition of a covered action. So we invite the district staff to engage with council staff in early consultation to discuss the project features and mitigation measures and to promote consistency with the Delta plan. So council staff are available to discuss those issues outlined in the letter as the district proceeds in the next stages of its project approval process. I do have a couple personnel announcements. We've been hiring, so please join me in welcoming new hires to the Delta Science Program in our collaborative science and peer review unit, Kim Luke and Dr. Ash Semenik. Prior to joining the Delta Stewardship Council, Kim Luke worked at the Center for Watershed Sciences, UC Davis, in an aquatic ecology lab focusing on fish, water quality, and zooplankton in the Northern Delta and Sassoon Marsh. Ash Semenik earned their PhD in ecology from UC Davis in 2017 and was an NSF postdoctoral researcher studying evolutionary ecology and biology education research. Ash then managed UC Berkeley's Sage Hen Creek Field Station, located in the Sierra Nevada Mountains. And most recently, they worked as a diversity and inclusion practitioner at CalPERS. I'd also like to welcome Annika Ragsdale to the Planning Division's newly formed Climate Change and Environmental Justice Unit. Annika comes to the Council as a recent graduate of UC Davis Master's in Science and Environmental Policy and Management Program and has a Bachelor's in Environmental Science from Cal Poly Humboldt. Annika spent the last 7 years in consulting, helping public sector clients understand and address climate risks. She worked on the High-Speed Rail's climate adaptation initiatives, developed transportation-focused climate change vulnerability assessments for tribal nations, and conducted sea level rise mapping in the Delta for Caltrans, among other projects. So I'm so happy to have these three join our team. And thank you to UC Davis for continuing to produce some high quality graduates. The outreach highlights report and active projects list are available in your packet and online. One highlight is that social media that promoted registration for our Science for Communities workshop earned a lot of attention and hopefully helped us get the word out for that successful event. So we don't have a legal update today, but I would like to invite Brandon Chapin up to provide a brief legislative update. So Brandon, welcome up to the table.
Morning, Chair and members. It's been a quiet month in politics. I do have a short presentation now. It's not very long because our legislature is in recess right now. So if I can get the next slide, please. The first is I just want to update on, and this kind of ties into Chair Lee's mention of the meet and greets that we've done, is on July 8th, council staff held a briefing for legislative staff on the U.S. Army Corps. Is that picking up? Okay. On the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers best practices for vegetation on levees. This is a big, I believe Jessica made an announcement about this a month or so ago. It's a big, potentially big sea change in levee maintenance in terms of allowing for multi-benefit projects and allowing for vegetation and upkeep on levees that includes that. And so this briefing for the legislature in collaboration with DWR was to raise awareness and encourage the submission of supportive comment letters from the legislature on this potential change. Given the savings, the recreational benefits, the ecosystem benefits, and flood protection benefits, we feel that the legislature, for something that isn't front of mind a lot, this is a good thing to bring up in front of them. And this ties in the a lot of the, this kind of runs the gamut of the briefings that we've been doing over the last few years to raise awareness of the council, raise awareness of Delta issues, and just be kind of more front of mind of the legislature. So the meet and greets I mentioned, there was a Delta Science program briefing a year and a half ago. Jessica presented at the Legislative Water Academy on the council on the Delta for staff, Delta Tour last year. The letter that we sent for the Delta Levees investment strategy completion, as well as the last 2 months has been the Delta Research Award seminar series, of which we have invited legislative staff to and have had roughly about four or five staff from the legislature in each of those research series webinars, which is great. Because that's one of the main impetuses for that series is to bring the findings front of mind to policymakers. So I think some really good momentum that the council's making in terms of getting in front of the legislature. Next slide, please. This is a little bit of old news since this was about a month ago, but I did just want to announce and let you all know that the legislature did pass and it was signed into law a climate bond that will be on the ballot here in November. And I wanted to walk through some of the details of this particularly in reference to what's of impact to the Delta. So the bond is $10 billion in total and will be on the November ballot for approval by voters. And of note, there's $550 million for flood management projects, including $150 million specifically for Delta levies. So I know that's one big thing that the council's been interested in is ensuring funding for Delta levies, and that is currently included with the bond if it does pass. $1.2 billion for biodiversity protection and nature-based solutions climate programs, including $29 million for the Delta Conservancy, as well as some other potential funding that's more broad and is given to the resources agency to divide up. So the Conservancy potentially could have more money there. And then also $300 million for climate smart, sustainable, and resilient farming, ranches, and working lands programs. Of note, 40% of all the funds must be spent to provide benefits to disadvantaged communities, and these funds cannot be used in any way to support an isolated Delta conveyance facility. That's a specific carve out in the bond. One point is that the public California PPIC did do a recent survey on this bond and found that 59% of voters support this bond. Of course, there's still quite a long way to go. As the last month has shown, a lot can change. So I'll continue to provide updates on this as we get closer throughout the year. With that, I will open up to any questions.
Any questions? Nope. Thanks, Brandon.
I will head into the next agenda item then. I'll go in and invite up our executive fellow, Menachi Odayapan. And while she's coming up, I just want to give a big thanks to Menachi for the work that she's done over the past year as an executive fellow. She joined us in October, I believe, from the executive fellowship program. It's a really nationally renowned program, and we've been lucky to have three fellows for the last 3 years. And Menachi's been a huge help in terms of legislative tracking, planning a lot of the briefings and work that we've done, including on her first day, which was the Delta tour, immediately thrown in to helping organize that. I will pass it on to her to give some reflections on her time here.
Well, thank you for the introduction, Brandon, and good morning, council members. It's been a very eventful 9 months so far, being the executive fellow for the council. I've been able to try so many things I haven't been able to experience before, which is like the benefit of a fellowship program and a very long one at that. And while it's sad to say, I will be ending my fellowship with the council in August, but as Brandon mentioned, I wanted to take the time to kind of reflect on what it's been like being a fellow at the council, but also just being an executive fellow in Sacramento at this time. So I think one of the big things I've learned in the fellowship is just being able to try new things. Brandon and Amanda have been so open to me just like saying I want to try something and trying to find a place to plug me in. I think that's the greatest part about being a fellow is that you get to be multitasking a lot, and it's the best thing ever. But I did want to highlight on four main things I've worked on as a fellow, which is in legislative affairs, DPIC, the EJ paper, and in a lot of research projects at the council. I really want to highlight legislative affairs in particular because Despite being a political science major, I've actually never touched legislative affairs before this fellowship, which I find is very surprising. I think as a political science major, it's usually the first thing you really touch. So it was a really cool experience for me just to try something brand new. And Brandon's been a great mentor and been walking me like through the steps and really taking the time to explain concepts to me that I never really understood. And I think it's really cool to see the legislative affairs position from a state agency standpoint, because usually in academics, you learn it from like the legislator standpoint. You learn how bills get passed, but you never really hear about the agencies, like how to do a bill analysis, how do you make speaking points when you do meet and greets. So I learned a lot under Brandon in legislative affairs. I've also been able to participate in DPIC. You might have seen me a few times in the DPIC presentations, and that's been a really cool experience, mainly because I've never organized a public meeting before. It's like my first time event planning. So it's really cool to be able to see DPIC from the start to the end and just see how the team was able to work around like the ups and downs of planning a public meeting, because there's always something that doesn't go as planned and you have to try to find a workaround. I think being able to help the team in finding those workarounds and also participating in DPIC and seeing the end result, April, I think everyone can agree it was a really good DPIC meeting. And just seeing that was a really helpful experience as a fellow. And then I also got plugged into the EJ paper, which actually I've never worked in EJ before this. So it was actually a really eye-opening experience reading the paper and seeing just the interactions between the council and organizations that work in the Delta. Amanda also allowed me to write the executive summary and some of the fact sheets. And those are really enjoyable experiences for me because I've always done academic-centered writing before this. And if you know academic-centered writing, it's very different from public-facing writing. So I kind of had to adjust how I write. And it taught me a lot of new skills that I hope to use in the future. And then finally, I also wanted to highlight some of the research I've done, in particular for the Delta Crosscut budget. I've been working on a comparative analysis of Delta science expenditures in comparison to other ecosystems in the US. I'm very much looking forward to when that goes public, and I'll be working on trying to finish that by the end of my fellowship, but it's been a very fruitful experience so far. And with that, I kind of also wanted to talk about the fact that I think the greatest part about being a fellow is the conversations. I think as a fellow, you get like a free card to just like say, hey, can I have a coffee chat with you? Can I have a meeting with you and learn about your career path, learn about what skills you've developed, get some advice. And as someone who's been trying to figure out what she wants to do for her future career, that's probably been the most like helpful experience as a fellow. And in addition to like more informal coffee chats, the fellowship itself does a great job of doing more like formal coffee chats. So actually just recently we had a meet and greet with Governor Gavin Newsom where we got the opportunity to ask him questions, learn more about his leadership and what it's like being the governor of California, which I think everyone can say is a very unique experience. Not everyone gets to have that. And I'm also looking forward to the fellows actually meeting with Governor Jerry Brown in the future, and just kind of comparing conversations of the previous governor with the current governor and just kind of seeing those differences. And with that, I kind of want to end off the presentation by just saying thank you for the council for having me as an executive fellow. Thank you for letting me be a fly on the wall and just kind of absorbing information, but also allowing me to be a team member and participating with my voice. I also want to say a special thank you to Brandon Chapin and Amanda Bull for being great mentors throughout these past 9 months and to the going month of August, and just kind of Lee taking me along for the ride and allowing me to ask questions when I don't know something, especially with the acronyms. I think I'm still learning that. And in general, just being open to me asking questions, even if they might be the most simplest question I can ask versus the most complicated question. And with that, I just want to say thank you for having me for the past 9 months. I'm looking forward to my last month and continuing after the fellowship working in climate change, wherever that takes me in the future. And with that, thank you.
Thank you, Jessica. Can I say a few words?
Yeah. Thank you. And thank you for all your contributions while you've been here. I know that you've been a valuable team member and people look at you as such. So we wish you the best of luck in your future endeavors. And someday we may all be working for you. Look forward to that. Oh, and Daniel has his hand up. Daniel.
Yeah, I just wanted to add my thanks to you for being such a valuable member of the team. And also for this very compelling and candid account of what it's like to be a fellow here. I feel like you really gave us a sense of why the program works and why it worked for you, and hopefully will continue to work for others. And I agree, I know you're gonna go on and do very important and great things. So good luck to you.
Yep, I am.
My observation is that you just jumped in and started swimming, and it did not come across flustered. You looked confident and joyful. I could see that you were getting great support, but your curiosity and your enthusiasm about the work that you're doing, I can't wait to see what you accomplish. And you really did contribute a lot while you were here. So thank you for being here.
How about one more round of applause? All right, we'll turn it back over to Jessica.
Thank you so much, Mina. I'm glad we get you for another month. Be careful, you might accidentally end up becoming the director of a state agency one day. So go into that eye wide open. Yeah, we've been fortunate. I believe Mina is our 8th executive fellow here. So for a small agency that hasn't been around very long, it's a pretty good track record. Hopefully we'll get another one come this fall.
Yes, hopefully.
So we have a pretty short meeting today. Next, you're going to hear from Delta Lead Scientist Lisa Marie Wyndham Myers. She's going to give us a detailed look at the By the Numbers report, what goes into that, what it means, why it matters, and then we'll conclude. So that pretty much wraps up my executive officer's report. Let me know if you have any questions, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? No. Nope. Emma, do we have any public comments?
No, Madam Chair, we do not.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, we have another hand up from Councilmember Zingali, though.
Yeah, Jessica, I was just going to ask, would there be any value or any reason not to ask Jorge to just read into the record publicly the validation of the documents? Because I feel like it might be left a little hanging, kind of he said, she said. And I just wonder if we should do that.
Sure, I have to find it, but I'd be happy to do that because it really is. We were very careful to be not controversial and state nothing but facts and just authenticate documents.
Yeah, I understand that. I just thought, just to be absolutely clear, because there obviously was some confusion.
Give me a moment.
You don't have it memorized.
Don't have it memorized. I just have to find it. I didn't have it queued up either, sorry. Yeah, you don't mind, yeah.
Yeah, I know I threw this at you kind of out of the blue.
If not, I can find it. And again, it is something, I did speak to OSHA. OSHA Serve was one of the attorneys who represents some of the parties in that litigation. And we discussed, and I did mention to her that, like, hey, like, if somebody asks us to authenticate documents, we're going to do that, and that we are neutral and we're not taking one side or the other. But if there are documents, like, we're custodians of those documents, we're going to make sure that the accurate documents gets presented.
All right. So we would have done that for either side of this argument.
Correct. And particularly, yeah. It's like, it's a good practice, particularly when one agency asks you to, hey, you know, rather than make them subpoena, we're just going to authenticate what the documents are. But I shall read it. I, Jeff Henderson, declare I am the Deputy Executive Officer for Planning and Performance Division of the Delta Stewardship Council. I have been employed as a Deputy Executive Officer since February 2018. I have personal knowledge of the facts set forth in this declaration and have called and sworn as a witness I could and would competently testify thereto. The following statements are based on my personal knowledge and upon my review of records kept by the Council. I have personal knowledge of the manner in which the Council's records are kept. Each of the records upon which I rely on was made in the ordinary course of business at or near the time of the act, condition, or event. The sources of information at the time of the preparation are such that I believe the records to be trustworthy. Paragraph 3, the Delta Plan policies have been codified as regulations and are set forth in Chapter 2 of Division 6, Title 23 of the California Code of Regulations. Staff have prepared a document for the public's ease of reference titled Delta Plan Policies that contain a table with all the Delta Plan regulatory policies and includes 1, a policy number and citation to the relevant section of the CCR for each policy, 2, a short title for each policy, and 3, the specific policy language from the CCR for each policy. Attached as Exhibit A is a true and correct copy of the document titled Delta Plan Policies, which I downloaded on July 18, 2024 from the Council's website, and it has a link that I won't pronounce because it'll keep us here for 10 minutes. It's pretty long. And any member of the public can access this document by clicking on the relevant hyperlink at this page of the Council's website, another link, last visited July 18, 2024. So that was the first statement. And then the second statement, yeah, go ahead.
Because this isn't agendized, isn't it unusual that we're discussing this in a back and forth?
The council member asked me a question, so I'm okay. Just answering the question. Okay.
Then it could fall under the legal update. I mean, we said we didn't have one. But...
Fair enough. But I mean, it was brought up by a member of the public. You know, the council member has asked, and you know, I'm happy to provide it because this is public information too.
In my experience, typically public comment on items that are not on today's agenda is not usually responded to in the other different meetings that I sit on. So that's why I'm asking. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, if the chair has any concern, I'd be happy. I can stop it.
I think it's better to clarify things with people, so I appreciate that.
Sure. On July, in the next paragraph, on July 27, 2018, the California Department of Water Resources Department submitted a certification of consistency to the council for the California Water Fix Project, also known as WaterFix. The 9 appeals were timely filed with the council opposing the certification of consistency. The council held a hearing on the appeals from October 24th to 26th. 2018 in West Sacramento, California. Upon conclusion of the hearing, the presiding officer directed council staff to prepare draft findings for the appeals based on the record and comments received in the matter. Accordingly, staff prepared draft findings for the appeals titled Determination Regarding Appeals and Certification of Consistency by the California Department of Water Resources for California Water Fix that was publicly issued on November 8th, 2018. The department subsequently withdrew its certification of consistency for the project, so that the draft was never voted on nor adopted by the council. A true and correct copy of the staff's draft determination regarding appeals of certification of consistency by California Department of Water Resources for California Water Fix is attached here too as Exhibit B. And then here there's a declaration or a penalty of perjury that's true and correct. And that's as simple as that.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to ask for public comment again because we added to it. So, yes, why don't we go ahead and have you do that?
All right. Thank you. So I think as you heard when you listened to the declaration, these were all publicly available documents, and there was no need for a council member staff to authenticate them. They were all judicially noticeable. I don't want to get into legal details, but there's just no need for the council staff to jump in for the second time in a declaration. And again, it's filed in support of the action, even if the staff believes it's neutral. I would like to request that the council reconsider its role in offering to assist agencies on matters that are going to come before the council, even if the staff believes that it's taking a objectively neutral role, because that can be interpreted different ways. And again, it's the appearance of impropriety and the concern that the residents of the Delta have about how the staff is interacting with DWR on these issues. It begs the question of what discussions were had with the staff regarding the consistency determination that will come before you and the litigation. And those are all happening outside of the public dialogue. Thank you.
Thank you for your comment. I appreciate that. All right, we're going to move on to the lead scientist report. I'll introduce Lisa Marie Wyndham Myers, our Delta lead scientist.
Thank you, Chair Lee, and thank you, council members, for having me present. I think, yeah, we'll just start with going through by the numbers. So, and then I'll end with some things to be on your radar. So by the numbers, you've been looking at this document for quite some time. Didn't always look like this. We've been providing these monthly snapshots since about 2013, and the format has changed quite a bit over that time. So we recognize that this is a choice of how we want to present this, and so we invite you to give us some feedback. So next slide, thank you. So the handout you're looking at, the document, and as well as what you're looking at on the right-hand side of this screen is this month's by the numbers. And it doesn't look a whole lot different than what you saw last month. Some things are up, some things are down. Haven't gotten a lot of rain, maybe a little bit in the Central Sierra, but the numbers are pretty similar to last month. And the purpose of this report is to really let you have a finger on the pulse of what's going on this year in the water year, so that it can help you understand water management decisions. We focus particularly in the current by the numbers on key metrics of water. So precipitation, reservoir storage, surface water flows, and water quality in that surface water. And we specifically focus on temperature and salinity because they're really critical to the uses, whether it's ecosystem uses or agriculture and urban uses. I want to note that this is a monthly snapshot. It's meant to engage with, you know, what you're reading in the news, what you're reading on the Maven's notebook. It's not a substitute for the much more detailed performance measures dashboard, which is more annualized reporting that the planning department does. And so if you're interested in some other details, you can poke around on that website and maybe be satisfied there instead of putting it in the monthly report. But I just wanted to plug that data set. So next slide, please. Thank you. When we report those numbers, we basically get them from two places. We get them from the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation's Central Valley Operations page, but primarily from the California Data Exchange Center website. And I put the link down there at the bottom. And it's just a tremendous resource. The database is maintained by Department of Water Resources. It has all manner of different hydrologic and climate data sets compiled, lots of sensors across this very large network, some going back way back and some only being maybe 10 years old. So there's historical data for some places, but not for others. So again, you can poke around on there and see some of these other summarized data sets if you're interested in some of those details. And so the next slide is going to give you a flavor of what we're talking about in terms of the kind of data on CDEC. There's precipitation sites all over the country. I'm sorry, all over the state of California. And there's 369 rain gauges available to us. There's water flow and quality stations also throughout the whole state. There's the water flow data that's telemetered to 2,700 sites for that flow numbers, and then water quality from 370 sites. And so we report on some few key sensors that are important that we think to the Delta water management decisions. And we can keep going to the next slide. Here's the reservoirs. There's actually 1,300 reservoirs in the state, but only 208 record data daily and then are served up through this CDEC site. And so we've chosen to report on the Shasta site because it's the largest federal reservoir. It plays a significant role in water management on the Sacramento River, the Oroville reservoir, as well as because it's the largest state reservoir, and then the San Luis reservoir because it's a good indicator of South Delta water supply. And then next slide, please. And you'll note that, again, in the colder months, we report on snowpack instead of temperature. We pull that section out. And in that case, we're looking at collections of snowpack data from the Snowtell monitoring system. And that's 22 stations in the Northern Sierra, 37 stations in the Central Sierra. And then we also report a statewide average just to get a sense of overall snowpack.
And traditionally, the snowpack was really one of our main infrastructures for water storage.
Absolutely.
And it's declining because of climate change.
Yeah, so that might be a particularly good one to follow trends on. Yeah, thanks. Okay, so next slide, please. So let's just step through what we're looking at on this page. The Northern Sierra report out here, this is the amount of inches of rainfall normalized over this 8-station index for this point in time for this year. So it's giving you the precipitation average, where we are at this point in time in this water year, and then what percentage of normal that is. So we color code this by blue because we're using a color coding system that tells us that that's just a little bit below the normal that we would expect at this point in time, but it's still close to 100% of the historical average.
Does the water year start in April or?
In October.
October, okay, got it.
Yep. And then the Central Sierra Index, so the next slide, is these sites, and that's actually a little bit lower, so that's in the 84% range. currently about what compared to historical averages. And those are the places that we've chosen to report because those are the two major watersheds that are entering the Delta. So those are those precipitation indices. I can keep going or I can take any questions on those precipitation data.
I do have a question because you mentioned, that the San Luis is kind of an indicator of the health of the Delta. And I know the San Luis has its own sources of water that come from the west, but I know the aqueduct runs through there, and there's another water body that where the water runs through. Is any of the San Luis River augmented by Delta water? Anything that flows through there, is it pumped up to the greater reservoir that you know of?
That's a good question, and I'm going to turn that to anybody who knows if that ever happens, but I don't know.
Because generally my question is that why it's an indicator, or is it just because it generally draws water from a mountain range that doesn't get the same amount of precipitation or snow that you would normally get in the Sierras?
It's an indicator because it's where we store all the water that we pump south from the state and federal water projects. So once you get past the Delta and you make it to San Luis, right, then you made it through the gauntlet, so to speak. And so then that water becomes available to contractors throughout the state and the south.
So the Delta also provides water to San Luis and it's diverted from there.
It's really a holding reservoir. I'm sure there's maybe minimal collection of local watershed water there, but it's pretty minimal.
That makes sense because I've always wondered how that reservoir exists. Anyway, thank you.
So that good question. So let's keep going then. So those reservoirs, and again, this little outline of the Delta, little backwards triangle there, just to give you a sense of where we are. Though San Luis is south of the Delta proper, and then Oroville and Shasta to the north. And when we look at these metrics on the right-hand side, we are reporting them in terms of not in terms of capacity per se, but in terms of historical averages. So we do show you on this graphic the remaining capacity, which is important for things like flood-informed reservoir operations, FIRO. But the numbers that we're showing you are the percent compared to average. And again, we're using a 20-year average for those.
And I was asking you questions related to that because it's there's been a certain time frame when water is released, and there's partly for water supply, but then there's also a time when they want to release to make sure that there's capacity for what's going to be coming, particularly if there's certain kind of weather events that are unusual. And so it's my understanding, and you know, please correct me, and if you don't know, it's okay, that those that are in charge of the releases are starting to change kind of the patterns and the kind of the limits of when they are to be more adaptive to climate change. Is that correct?
Oh, it is absolutely correct. I think you may have had a presentation even before one that I gave you on flood-informed reservoir operations, which is basically gauging, you know, where are we going to have an El Nino year? Do we need more capacity?
Well, that was the question I was asking. Yeah. And sometimes I ask questions that you've answered before, but maybe this is the first time someone's listening or watching. So that's part of the reason why I'm asking. Yeah. So there's been some discussion about El Nino and La Nina. And where are we at that point with this?
Well, we're just coming out of an El Nino setting where the ocean has been warmer, but it's now back to neutral. And the question is, are we going to swing into a La Nina and be drier?
La Nina would probably be more of a drought period.
Yes.
Okay, sorry. Thank you.
No problem. We don't know, though, so we can't really predict that.
I have a question as well. So the percentage next to the name of the reservoir reflects the percent of current storage. Is that what that is? So on San Luis, it says 95%. So that would be the dark line, but it's above the average storage line.
It's the current percentage of average current storage. Is that right? So this time of the year, there would normally be a little less in Oroville and a little more in San Luis this time of the year, right?
That's exactly correct. Yes.
And then the line at the very top, I'm answering your question, sorry, is the full storage, but that's for when.
Right. So the dark line above the average storage line is 95% of the average storage. So shouldn't the dark line be below the dotted line?
Yes.
Okay.
So Julie, you your graphic eyes have caught an error there. So that black line should be
I thought I knew how to read these, and then I was looking at the picture and I was like, maybe I don't know how to read these.
I think they're so close to each other with 95% that it was a mistake.
Okay.
Thank you though for pointing that out.
Okay. No worries. I'm not trying to point out mistakes. I just
no. It's good to see, but it is basically close to the average.
Okay.
And so they almost overlap.
Okay, got it.
And then Shasta, of course, is a little bit higher than average, which is great. Okay, let's keep going then, unless there's more questions. The next one is water temperature. So, there's a lot of stations we could be reporting on. We've chosen three that are important to water management decisions. One of them is Clear Creek, and that's the northernmost station on the Sacramento River below the Shasta Dam. And so what you're looking at here is the temperature in the water on average for July, so from July 1st to today, so that would be 25 days, that average, just for July. And what you're looking at is how the color coding on it is how it compares to the past. So for example, on the left, we color code it by how it compares to last month, and it's pretty darn similar. So that's why it's basically that dark blue. And then on the right, is how it compares historically to the last 20 years or 27 years. I think in this case, we have a 27 year record. And it's basically, again, very close to the historic average.
Ismael, you talk about water management. Can you talk about what that means? Because you're talking about probably fish species and habitat.
Yeah.
And so can you talk about, and are these, you said that like they control the temperatures. Can you talk about how that's done?
Sure. So Clear Creek is, if you compare Clear Creek to the other two, Collinsville, which is basically right near Sassoon, right near the salinity gates there, and then Clivecoat Forebay, which of course is right where the pumps are headed south. At Clear Creek, they maintain that temperature with cold water releases from Shasta Dam. So there actually isn't that much swing in the summers, because it's being managed to be in, below 60 degrees in that zone. They release water at about 50 degrees from the Shasta Dam. And so it's keeping, even though it's warm up there in Shasta County right now, they're keeping that water cold by these cold water releases.
So in other words, some of the storage is helping manage the temperature.
Absolutely.
And so that's part of the water management. It's not just water supply, it's also managing that the water temperature for various species.
Yeah, and I mean the key reason, just for clarity, why species have particular temperature thresholds, there's a lot of reasons, but one of the main ones is that warmer water holds less oxygen. So having lower temperatures allows more dissolved oxygen to be in the water. So this is how fish breathe through their gills. They need the oxygen. So the lower temperatures allow basically more species to succeed there. And then also just, more fecundity and better life histories for those fish at lower temperatures. So we can keep going down this site. So the next one, actually, if we go to Collinsville, let me just point out, can we go back one? I'm so sorry. Thank you. So Collinsville, again, that's the gauge that's right at like the Carquinez Straits area, right there in the Sassoon, where the confluence of the two rivers are. And then Clifton Court Forbay is the water that's headed down through the State Water Project in the California Aqueduct. Okay, thank you. All right, and then so the last quadrant here, this lower right one, is the, we combine both the water flow and quality in that one graphic. And so we report basically the two inputs to the Delta through the Sacramento River at the north end, that's Freeport. And then at the south end, that's Vernalis. And that's basically Sacramento River coming in and then the San Joaquin River coming into the Delta. And then we also report a combined export through the pumps into the Central Valley Project and State Water Project aqueducts through that diversion. And so we report these just so you can understand, you know, the amount of water coming in, the quality of the water coming in, you know, are the salinities getting high or not? Again, we color code these by how they compare to July's of the past. So the last 20 years of July averages, so that you can see whether, you know, it's high or low compared to other July periods. In the month of July, that's what we're doing. And every month, this is how we color code it. So just to give you a sense of how this compared to last month, the Sacramento River is actually a little higher and the San Joaquin River is down about half. So it's dropped, and this is the first time I've reported where it's actually colored red, which is basically less than 50% of the historic average. So that was interesting for me to take a look at, and I poked around and looked at a couple other gauges, and it's real. So I don't think I understand exactly why, but it's in the multiple stations.
Are the flows down here affected by the reservoir releases?
At the San Joaquin River? No, I mean, there are reservoirs, but they're not major ones.
Yeah.
On the San Joaquin. Can you think of one that's Bryant? Yeah. So the Bryant Dam, and I don't know the Bryant Dam release history. I've only been looking at the other reservoirs.
I mean, I'm not an expert in San Joaquin flows and Vernalis Point, but I mean, this is just people are diverting.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's the season.
Right.
And then they basically have not a voluntary agreement, but a court ordered agreement on the San Joaquin for the restoration flows. So I'm sure this is all highly regulated, but I am surprised to see it red as well. So I don't know the reason for that.
I also want to point out though, I looked at the history of that, and last year at this time, that San Joaquin was running 10,000 CFS. Oh. And then during the drought, it was running 100 CFS. So they're in July's. So it actually does vary quite a bit. So when we're looking at an average, you're not seeing the variance around that. And so that data point from Vernalis is actually pretty variable. So that said, the combined diversions are about on par with what they've been historically. So no real differences there. And again, very similar to what we saw in June.
You have salinity there? Is that what those are? And I don't know how to read the symbol. Is that units of salt per centimeter or something like that? What is that?
So the way, basically parts per million on the right, actual dissolved solid and actual salt concentration by weight, parts per million. But the microsievens is a measure, that's the little U with the little squiggly. That's microsievens per centimeter. And that's actually a metric of electrical conductivity. So it's another way you can do continuous reporting. Instead of having to take a sample, you can just constantly measure that. And it's a good index of salinity. So those numbers are all within the range of what you would expect in a freshwater system.
Healthy?
Yeah.
Okay. They look good. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and that's important for also habitat.
Mm-hmm.
Is it also important related to processing drinking water?
Absolutely. And okay. to agriculture as well.
Right.
Different crops have different thresholds.
Okay.
What's the comparison of the, I mean, I know that they're in green. Is the 59 parts per million next to that, is that the average or?
So some people like to think about salinity in parts per million or parts per thousand and things like that.
Oh, okay.
And so we report it in those units just so people that like to see it in PPM have that number. But the data that we're primarily reporting is, bless you, is the microsiemens, because that's the continuous gauges that we can get.
Okay, got it.
Fed.
So our comparison of averages there is just the green color coding to say it's within the norms of the averages.
Yes.
Okay, thanks, Angley.
Great. Okay, and next slide. Thank you. All right, so there's a lot of ways we can change this. We can do new data. We can do different sites. We can do trends. There's some things you might want an environmental snapshot on, like harmful algal blooms, or I know you heard last month about nutria detections, but these are things we can serve up on a monthly time step. Invasive aquatic vegetation, salmon catch migrations, particularly when the runs are significant. So, you know, in the past, we used to report Delta smelt every month, and then it just became a little too consistently depressing. So I think we stopped reporting that. But the point being, there's a lot of things we can report. Then our fellow, Jessica Weidenfeld, in addition to many other skills, is a fantastic coder. So she can pull data and make magic and whatever it is we want. So she basically just pulled together what it could look like if we wanted to do a trend in July water temperatures at Clear Creek. And so this is an example she just put together. And it might look, super variable. But the truth is, if you look, is every one of those data points for July is basically between 56 and 60. I mean, because again, this is a very regulated site. But that said, there still are these sort of hot year moments where it's hot, like 1998 was a very hot summer. And that's why you're seeing a high value there. And then I don't know if you can see this on the right-hand side, but last year was cooler. And then this year we're kind of back to the normal July temperatures. So, that's one way we could serve up data is in these trends. But there's a lot of data that can be leveraged from, again, the CDEC, from the State Water Board, from California Department of Fish and Wildlife. And we really invite you, and I think that's my last slide, is to tell us what you would like to see and buy the numbers every month to help you keep a finger on the pulse of what's going on with water and the implications of that in the Delta.
Yeah, go ahead.
I know that after doing our get together on DPIC at DPIC related to harmful algae blooms, we're still kind of getting set up as far as data. But I do think that as that starts to build, it's a good part of the discussion. So I think, you know, I'm going to kind of encourage us to keep that in the conversation appropriately. The other thing I'm interested in is the impacts of wildfires, the weather patterns, and the effect on, you know, water storage or water quality, you know, especially in those areas where the water is running off. And so since we're having so many issues with wildfires, I just want to kind of have that as a consideration of how that's impacting, you know, the precipitation, the supply, and the quality of the water.
And there's science products that can address that. I don't think that we have anything served up monthly, but that is a topic of great concern in the science community.
Member Huesa.
Mine is a more general kind of, higher from the sky looking down question. And I know we've had this conversation before, and I know we've had this conversation in the briefings, but it relates to kind of the Delta's role in creating studies and those studies being done by the independent scientists and coming up with findings or any kind of data or any kind of analysis that goes through the, are the board members, in terms of our participation in this process, are we just simply the ones that kind of receive the information? Is there, and this may be more of a question to our director, executive director, Jessica Pearson, but what do the members themselves, the members of this council, have any input into what studies are done? Is there any way for us to kind of lead if we gather an interest in any one scientific area to want to work to either raise funds, work kind of the federal and state governments to take a more in-depth look at certain areas? If it is something that we take an interest in, is that a proper role for this council to engage in?
Well, I'd be interested in your ideas. I think the way we allocate funds for science now are a couple different ways. One is directed actions by the lead scientist. So the lead scientist having the, eyes out, scanning for what are the important opportunities where a little bit of council science funding can go a long way to advance management questions and scientific discovery. We also go through a multi-year collaborative process with the public to identify science priorities for the Delta, and then that informs our competitive research award solicitations. So I think typically we're looking across the community for broad input about what the priorities are, and then really though our lead scientist has a strong hand in making those determinations. If there are areas of interest that the board want to explore, we can have those conversations. But that's the process that we use now.
Yeah, I mean, just generally, if I had an interest, it would generally come from somebody in the community, right? Or somebody in some leadership aspect in the community that wants the Delta to work on certain things. And normally that request would come either to you or to the lead scientist directly.
Yeah, I'll let Lisa talk about how those things come to pass.
We generally do competitive calls for science awards. That's how we've been doing research awards. In the past, we've had more funding to do directed actions that do come out of community engagement and hearing what people want to work on and what we think is a critical need at that time. We're not in the place to have a lot of funding for directed actions at this moment, but we do have an active research award that is extremely receptive to community input. We actually have a special section in the review process highlighting community participation. So there's opportunities for communities to be funded. In fact, at the Science for Communities workshop, I'm not sure if you saw that presentation. I believe Rachel Klopfenstein ran it about how do you do this? How do you get support and to just encourage more engagement. But yeah, I'd love to hear your ideas. I think there's, you're clearly poised to understand some of the key questions that we might want to address. There's just not a lot of funding at the discretion of the science program right now.
Yeah, Diane.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different agencies that are doing research as well. But can you talk about the difference between the lead scientist and the independent science board?
Sure. They're two separate, it's a separate division, right? So the independent, I'm sure I'm going to not have it completely perfect, but the independent science board really does serve to to advise you on larger.
But they're not directed as much as they get to kind of bring us information, correct? Or is it directed by us?
You are welcome to engage with them on questions that you have that you would like them to address.
But they set their own agenda.
Right.
Yeah, so the Delta Independent Science Board was created in the Delta Reform Act, and it's 10 internationally or nationally renowned scientists that have expertise in certain fields of study. They are usually recruited by the Delta lead scientist, and then they are appointed by the council. But then once they are appointed into that position, then they set their own agendas as a board. Delta lead scientist position also created in the Delta Reform Act. And as we just saw through the recruitment process and the hiring process, we partner with the USGS, with the Independent Science Board, and then the council ultimately makes the selection for the Delta lead scientist.
And this has been done to help bring people together, because a lot at one point people were bringing their own science that supported their own position. And so now there's this kind of idea that we're all trying to be on the same page as far as science.
Correct? Yeah, I think there was broad recognition in reviewing, the CalFed process, that one of the most valuable governance aspects of CalFed was having an independent science board, a science program, and a lead scientist to bring transparency and to elevate Delta science and the investments that we make in Delta science, and to build trust in that science so that we're working from a shared body of work rather than individual organizations, coming to their own conclusions. Now, of course, there are still a lot of entities that are doing that science, but that's why we also promote peer review and some of these collaborative events to make sure that, that those conclusions are well reviewed, that they're supportable, and that they're widespread throughout the community so that they can be applied.
And the cool thing is that you're also, it's in more recent years, we've added the social sciences, which helps give it more dimension.
And that was a recommendation from the Independent Science Board that we do so.
And the past research awards call and this one highlights social science directions in the projects. So it's not the soft science anymore. We are definitely giving it the attention that it deserves. It's a necessary component of management.
Yeah. I'm particularly interested in the HABS map that you guys pulled up here. I mean, it seems like it's something that we should at least have an awareness of, especially if it's, directly affecting the Delta. I wouldn't mind to see that incorporated into our by the numbers if everybody else thinks that that's something that they'd like to look at every month. You guys like that idea? Oh, Daniel has his hand up, I think. Or no? No, okay. That was just the little icon on the screen, the hand. Got it. All right, well, why don't we add the HABS to it, and then we can think about if there's anything else that we'd like to see since we've gotten this presentation and you've got our creative juices flowing. I don't know, to Councilmember Burgess's comment about the impact of wildfires, if there's data available that we could turn into something for this or not, but it might be something that we could check on. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, as maybe like a special event, if there's something to report, I suppose we can. But I'm trying to think if this is the performance plan measures that we currently report, that you've heard this presentation before. I'm not sure if there's a wildfire component in here, but that might be a place to go for that. But regardless, we can pay attention to that because it's obviously something that will continue to grow. And with the harmful algal blooms, that what you're looking at is this is the reporting site from the State Water Board. I've forgotten the name, something like MyHabs website, where anybody can call in or make a report, and then they will verify it. So it's a useful site, and it's updated regularly, nice. Like every day.
Cool. The problem with the harmful algae blooms is that the reporting is based on finding it, and finding it's based on looking for it, and looking for it in certain areas might be more often than in other areas. So it's not a complete picture. Is that?
It's true, but the other problem is that there's satellite imagery that's used,
right.
But the scale of the satellite imagery is not getting into the tiny channels, which
right.
is the satellite imagery we're using is 300 meters wide, and it's, you know, daily updates, or every 3 days is when they report out. But getting into those little 10 meter wide channels where we tend to have blooms, that we don't have that.
That's why I was talking about drones with the scientist that was talking about that. So, yeah.
Yes. And so that whole work group now, the State Water Board has funded USGS to develop a program, the MERHAB project, forgot the M part of it, but it's basically environmental response for HABs. That project, it's $5 million from NOAA, you know, State Water Board, USGS, SFEI running this project, that will develop better tools. So it's we're getting there, but right now it's a little bit coarse, the daily updates on.
Yeah, the worry that I have is if somebody sees that and they don't see anything in their area, that doesn't mean it's not there. It's just
right.
that we haven't discovered it necessarily.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah. So another reason to highlight it would be to make sure that the public knows this is how you call it in.
Yeah.
We might get more reports that way.
Yeah, that's great. Right. Thank you for that.
Oh, yeah, thank you. So let me just step through then the last information items on the LSR. Yeah?
Yes.
Okay, great. So so we have basically four things to highlight. The first is you heard from the Collaborative Science and Peer Review Unit last week, and you heard from Bureau of Reclamation and DWR about their use of our peer review. The most recent one is the Summer Fall Habitat Action evaluation, and we know it's going to be widely cited and used. It's four letters came out of it, it's a very powerful assortment of letters. It's not a single report. If you're interested, I would poke around and take a look at those letters. Two are focused on the structured decision making that went into the suggested actions for smelt habitat.
When you say letters, can you explain what you mean?
Oh, sure. So there was a charge from the Department of Water Resources to get feedback from expert scientists. And we had two sets of those. We had two ecologists and two structured decision-making experts to take a look at the DWR's planned actions to enhance habitat for Delta smelt. And the focus was primarily on making more zooplankton for them to eat, and making and then also things like the salinity and turbidity patterns that were necessary for smelt recovery. And so those letters are directly from, they're not synthesized, they're directly from the two ecologists and from the two structured decision-making experts. And not only is there similarities between them, things that they point out about some potential improvements, and also some real, you know, kudos. They actually thought they did a great job, DWR, but also gave them some suggestions moving forward. Those letters are worth looking at simply because they each have their own unique contributions, and we're waiting actually to hear from DWR how they're going to be using this. And so you didn't have them last month at your meeting on this because they're still processing how they're going to use this, because it affects their incidental take permit that they received. So they need to take a look at these reviews in the process of getting that approved. And then after the That was one thing that just came out, and it's wonderful. Again, a website to look at, the charge, the transparency, the letters. The next thing to point out was that the National Ecological, the National Center for Ecological Analysis and Synthesis, NCES, we still have that partnership. We're starting to have the final, we have the final workshop, and we're starting to have some products that we expect to be presenting to you in December. This is, again, 16 early career scientists across agencies that participated in this, and they focused on, in this, you heard already about the food web work that was done by one NCES working group, but this one is focusing on managing the Delta's socio-ecological system, and then the other on integrating human dimension data into the research and management decision making. And so these are much more social in their structure. And those reports we expect to see at the end of the year, again, hopefully to present to you. But they had their final workshop. The other thing to point out that just happened is we had our last of the Delta Research Awards seminars. There was a seminar series from late May to the middle of July, and they were wonderful to listen to. I know Henry presented on these last month, so you know that these are well attended. It's about 36 people on each call, as ever there had been. But these are all covering topics from that are all relevant to all these decisions: wetland carbon, social decision making for habitats, habitat prioritization, historical data from algal blooms, sea level rise, and so on. And the talks are so short, they're just 15 minutes. We're actually going, I just summarized them for the Delta Independent Science Board meeting, but I'm gonna do another summary of these and then post it for, again, to whet your appetite to actually go in and watch the actual short 15 minute videos that these presenters put together, because they were an incredible cohort of research projects. And then the last thing to point to is the Bay Delta Science Conference. So registration is live. If you want the early bird rate, which just saves you $100, you have until August 19th to get that rate. The abstract, the schedule has been decided on. At some point, it's going to go live on the web as well. The abstracts will also go up on the web. But yeah, we are expecting a high attendance at this conference because it's the first time in 6 years we've had it. And there's, over 300 abstracts submitted. So it's
And where is it?
At the State Convention Center downtown Sacramento.
Nice.
So again, that date for the meeting is September 30th through October 2nd. And yeah, we look forward to as broad a group as possible because the purpose of the theme of the meeting is cultivating connections in a dynamically changing environment. And that's all I have.
Excellent. Are there any other member comments? No? All right. Emma, are there any public comments?
No, Madam Chair, there are not.
All right. So our next agenda item is preparing for the next council meeting, which will take place on August 22nd. So please refer to the posted meeting notice for further information or updates. And with that, we'll conclude our meeting. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Daniel.